So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Tonight, one man hopes to implement the final phase of his royal plan.
King Mabel will be the next World Wrestling Federation champion.
The reigning WWF champion, running on high octane, is determined to set that plan aflame.
I'm gonna come at you with a blowtorch, and your kingdom... soon, Armageddon.
Tonight, one man still suffering the shame of a most humiliating defeat hopes his demented dentist can extract revenge.
SummerSlam, Hitman, your career is terminal.
But this so-called patient claims to be master to the art of dentistry as well.
I know you like to pull out teeth, but I like to knock them out the old-fashioned way with this.
Tonight, these WWF superstars must all face the heat as Supersized Tridex Pads present WWF SummerSlam.
It is Review Away. I am John Pollock with Wei Ting, bright and early on a Wednesday morning with you.
Early? Yeah, talk about early. It feels like it's several days early.
Wow.
More than usual.
I don't know what day of the week it is.
It's Wednesday.
It is Wednesday.
Looking at my calendar.
Yep.
On my watch.
Yep. It says Wednesday.
Wednesday.
It's a weird word, Wednesday.
Yeah.
The spelling of it.
Yeah, it is.
Like, how many words have a silent D in them?
Maybe we just pronounce it wrong.
Wednesday.
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 Yeah, wedness.
Wedness.
Yeah. Wednesday. It's like suplex or suple.
I was going to say maybe it was before Saturdays became a big day for marriage. It was wed day.
Yeah, wed day.
Getting...
wedness. Maybe it was like the day where everybody, like, you know, like back then, maybe people didn't shower as often, and like the one day of the week where you shower was the wetness day.
And then it was repeated so many times the wrong way that the D replaced the T.
Yeah,
I mean, if you're gonna pick a day of the week to clean yourself, it would be in the middle, wouldn't it?
I would say so. Yeah,
you know, you come out of the weekend. You can maybe stretch a day or two, but you can stink by Sunday, by Wednesday.
Wednesday would be the day to clean yourself, I would say. The rest of the week, come on, the weekend, you don't need to deal with that.
No.
Though I love showers. Like I
love them?
I fucking love them, yeah. It's like relaxing, meditative.
You strike me as the bubble bath type.
No.
No?
No. I never do that stuff.
You don't have, like, a bathrobe with, like, your initials on it?
Do not have that.
WTT?
No. Do not have that. Nor do I see the appeal. I don't know.
A bubble bath?
Of a bathrobe. That whole thing.
Oh, a bathrobe.
Bubble
well,
bath.
If you're open and...
What?
I'm just saying bathrobes are meant to cover you up. Maybe you don't believe in that kind of thing.
I mean, I just... I don't know. Like, if I get home, like, I don't necessarily want to put myself in a
bathrobe.
A toweled suit.
That's what it is. Yeah.
It's just heavy. I just dry myself off and then wear something comfortable.
A bathrobe could be comfortable. I don't think you can knock the comfort of a bathrobe.
Do you have a bathrobe?
I don't have one, no.
Well, then you're missing out then, apparently.
I go home and I put a suit on.
Suit on.
An actual
suit. Do you like baths?
No, I can't even remember.
You definitely do not strike me as the bath type.
No, way too long.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you strike me as like the type of guy who'd be like, this is very inefficient. Like, you seem like the type who just wants to get in and get out of the shower.
Well, that's the appeal of a shower. I mean, it can be done very quickly.
I like to take my time though sometimes.
How's too long? How much?
Too long of the
20
shower?
Minutes?
That's
really long.
It's long, yeah.
20 minutes.
That's doable sometimes,
because
yeah.
I've had to wait for you before at Open Mat to give me a ride home, and you do take your sweet time.
I get every crevice. Every crevice. But even just like standing
you
there.
You are preventing staff, so that's
yes.
That is a good kind of time to
but
take.
But just even standing there with like the hot water and the steam, it's like I get a lot of my great thinking done, you know? And it's like it's just calming. So we're talking about showers now.
Did you have a shower over the last 24 hours and think of a dentist?
No.
Or how shitty some pay-per-views were in 1995?
Did not really cross my mind in the shower.
I can't say it did for me either. Though I'm surprised we didn't have a man in 1995 whose gimmick was not showering.
Yeah, I'm sure we did.
Henry Godwin, maybe.
What about the Bastion Booger?
Or, you know what? Yeah, I guess so. Though they never really emphasized the non-cleaning aspect. Like something Jim Herd would have come up with, like a guy smelt so bad that you couldn't touch him or get near him.
They emphasized shit with that character. Like he had like a chocolate bar that he found somewhere. Like they did an angle once where like there's like a chocolate bar that was like they wanted us to believe that it was shit, and then like he took the chocolate bar and he ate it, thinking that he ate shit.
I have drastically, you know, I don't listen now any longer to too many different wrestling. I just find it's incredible how many podcasts are out there for wrestling. I do make a point now to try and catch Ric Flair's because I find it so damn entertaining to hear Ric Flair.
Yeah, in what way?
Well, last week he just took questions from people. He was at Roddy Piper's funeral. He couldn't record a show with a guest. And, I mean, if you've never listened to the show, it's like Flair just has a guest on and like. It's as if they're just chatting on the phone with no regard to recording.
Well,
and Flair is just...
I mean, you remember the whole thing with the video game panel and how afraid they've been since then of putting this guy near a live mic. Well, here's 2 hours a week of this guy in front of a live mic.
Oh, the stories I've heard of this guy. I mean, Mike Rotunda climbing over a fence with barbed wire and slicing his scrotum in half. But this other story he told that your story jogs my memory because I just heard this was they were doing a dark match after Raw some night and it was Hunter and Flair, I think Batista and definitely Jericho. They were all involved in some form or fashion, this dark match. And Triple H took a protein bar and put it in the back of his trunks. So then Jericho goes over for a sunset flip. Pulls down and Hunter's tights come down and the protein bar falls out into Jericho's mouth. So the whole crowd thinks that Jericho has just stomached a turd. And apparently Jericho loses his shit and this sounded hilarious.
What timing, like, you know, must you have to be able to drop this
impeccable fish. And it sounds like Jericho had no idea, so he's believing that a turd just fell out of Hunter's pants into his mouth.
Well, regardless of whether or not it was a real turd, this thing was in this dude's ass crack. Okay, I wouldn't want anything.
I don't know if it was right in the crack or where it was displaced.
I wouldn't want it anywhere.
There was probably a connection with the cheek.
Something has been in any man's trunks or underwear. I do not want it in my mouth. So
that's
I mean,
a great rule to live by.
I suppose it's a testament to the timing of one Triple H to be able to drop that deuce right into Jericho's mouth.
I wonder what time period this was in.
Maybe like early 2000s.
It would have to be, yeah. Maybe that 03, 04 period. But nonetheless, a very funny story from Ric Flair.
Precisely.
So go listen to his podcast. Okay. I get a lot of enjoyment out of it. If nothing else, listen to the interview he did with Kevin Sullivan. If that doesn't sell you on the show, if you don't like that show, you'll hate Ric Flair's podcast. That is the barometer. But we're chatting about something that in some ways resembled a turd in your mouth, and other times it was like a gold bar in your mouth.
Yes.
There was good and bad on this show is what I'm trying to say.
Gold bars in your mouth. Yeah.
What would be something great to fall out of someone's trunks that you wouldn't mind falling in your mouth? Is there anything? A gold bar would be if you could keep it.
What a question.
I don't know.
Not really a question
for a wetness day.
I'm really trying to think. What would that's really a stumper. What would fall out of a man's ass into my mouth that I would really love?
Maybe I'll let you think about it, and I'll ask you tomorrow on Thursday. We're done. We'll talk to you next week. This is the stupidest show. I don't know why anyone listens to this.
I don't know either, man. I don't know.
If you are still with us, some 10 minutes into this show, we're going to chat about SummerSlam 1995 from Sunday, August 27th of 1995. You know what drives me insane on the network? They still haven't corrected the dates. They're all off by a day for most of the pay-per-views. This is listed as August 26th.
That's weird.
I'm the only one who notices this.
Maybe it's like...
But there's other... I looked, actually, the Nitros that they put up. They're all the correct dates. But then, the pay-per-views and I think the Raw, they're all... I'm sure it's just some system malfunction where it's off by a day.
It could be it. I wonder if...
Though I don't know why.
Maybe they finish, processing the shows or, taping the shows after midnight. Sometimes I wonder, when we do review Raw, we always date the show the day after the actual episode. You know what I mean? We date it on Tuesday.
Yes.
So, sometimes I wonder, are people going to have a hard time finding this? Because, the dates don't necessarily match the episode of Raw. So I wonder if it could be something like that. But actually, the network error kind of helps us. Because people want to find that episode of Raw, it's a day later, just like our episode.
Right, right. Well, should we change our dates then?
I mean, if I'm not going to deal with that.
I always just dated it because I figure people wake up and they want to see the latest show, which corresponds with the date.
It makes sense how we date it, yeah. So,
though I don't do that for the Law, because I feel that's a live show on the date that it takes place.
I think the system's
Believe
fine.
Me, I've given this thought.
Oh, yeah, of course. I think the system's fine.
All right. I'm just going to list them now as August. No dates.
I do like our titling, though.
I went back as I was watching this, and every so often I'll look at the latest Raws and what they named them. Ours are way better, dude.
What's some of the latest gems?
I've got to pull it up. But, I mean, ours, I think, listen, we put some time into these. I mean, these are not easy. And... to be quite honest, I think that the company, I think it's a very last minute decision.
New Orleans. Louisiana.
New Orleans. I was not a fan of that one, but looking back, I was like, eh, it worked. It did work. All right, let's find this. Raw replays. Okay. Are you ready for these?
Yeah. Let's hear some of these.
These are the last few, okay? We're going to go back.
For people who don't know, if you go on the network and look up old episodes of Raw, they'll always name it the episode, they'll subtitle it. Whatever, I guess the script says, and they always put some funny pun, which I'm assuming they never expect people to see, but because of the network, we now get to see what these shows are actually titled.
Okay, I'm gonna do the last four that are posted on the network, and then I'm gonna compare them to what we named. Okay. Yeah. So this will be some fun interaction here. Awesome. Okay, the June 22nd episode of Raw. This is the WWE version. Reunited. And it hurts so good. Our title, which is in Mandarin.
Oh, it's the Mandarin one.
What was that? What was the name even? Oh, it was the Cena insult he used. I can't remember what it's called.
I can't say that one is better, but I like it more.
Okay, June 29th. Washington, BG.
What?
I don't even know what the fuck
Washington,
that means.
Washington,
BG.
Who the fuck is BG? Who's BG?
B.G. James? I don't know.
Washington?
Is that supposed to be a play on D.C.? That's not even...
Are you sure it doesn't say 86?
No.
B6? B.G. Isn't that what...
Yeah. That's a B.G.
What the fuck does B.G. mean?
Okay, I think we're going to win this one.
Okay, what's ours?
Don't drive a Mercury, drive Cadillac. That was when the Cadillac was introduced, because he attacked Joey Mercury.
I know.
Or no, he introduced it. The attack was the following week.
Well, I mean, I wasn't... Okay. It's better
than
Washington,
we're getting into the good ones here. Because both of ours here correspond. July the 6th. WWE's was Cadillac Attack. ours Cadillac-ed.
Because it's Brock Lesnar with the axe. Yeah, ours
was that was better. A slam dunk.
Cadillac attack. Fuck off.
And then the last one they have posted, because they're a month delayed, the Cadillac Conqueror was the WWE version. Ours, my favorite, Developmental Call-Ups.
Diva, yeah, because it was the debut of the Divas, yes.
So there's some good ones.
We're way smarter. We're way better people.
A damn good job.
Yeah.
Okay, how did that get off here? Oh, yeah, the date of this pay-per-view was August 27th of 95 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
The home of the most famous Hell in a Cell match in history.
Yes, okay, cool.
Which you and I were just talking about the other day. Because
we were.
I'm going to remind you. Each week, Dave Meltzer posts a classic edition of The Observer, and I love skimming through these, and they're up to June of 98, and it's the week before the King of the Ring. And they noted how The Undertaker had hurt his ankle the week before, had to miss a house show. They actually postponed some house shows as a result of it, and the line is something to the effect of, he is still set for the Hell in a Cell match with Mankind, but he'll be very limited, and Mankind will have to do the majority of the carrying in the match. Which he did.
He
did a hell of a lot in that match.
He did some carrying. He did some
falling.
Unloading as well.
Yes, he did.
Yes.
Pretty amazing that Taker's ankle was so messed up, and he climbed that cell to the top.
Well, I mean, thinking back about that match in particular, I mean, after watching a Shawn Michaels match on this show, I think I started to think a lot about Shawn's more memorable 90s performances, and I think everybody still talks about that first Hell in a Cell match as being the better wrestling match.
But, of course.
But everybody remembers the second one.
For the stunts, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, both matches are great, but there's for slightly different reasons. In the second match, The backstory involved in it is just so incredibly compelling. And of course, features perhaps the most dangerous stunt we've ever seen in the WWF.
And probably one that we'll never see replicated. For good reason.
Nor should it. Yeah. The guy got really fucking lucky.
If you're around Mick Foley now and you see this guy moving around, you see the toll that stuff like that took on him.
Yeah.
The show starts off with a video package. This was, you know, every summer. You know, it's who is going to be the big focal point of the promotion. And this summer, it was King Mabel.
Oh, boy.
What a summer it was. Winning the King of the Ring.
Mm-hmm.
A horrendous show.
Which we haven't done yet, have we?
95, we might have done. That was a show in Philadelphia. We had the video package featuring WWF champion Diesel threatening to come after Mabel with a blowtorch. As well as Lawler bringing his demented dentist, Isaac Yankum, onto the scene.
Yeah.
And threatening to pull out the teeth of Bret Hart, who said he's going to knock them out the old-fashioned way. We would have so many teeth puns in this particular show. A new record for the company.
A lot of teeth puns. A lot of puns in general. I mean, these opening videos, you know, we think today Roman Reigns' scripted promos sound so corny, but corniness was at its peak, I'd say, in the mid-90s in the WWF. I mean, these videos, they kind of played like Maury Povich recaps, like as about they're about to introduce, like, baby's not mine, you're crazy. Like, these played like that.
Piece of shit made me kiss my own foot, so I got my demented dentist to come in and pull your teeth out, bitch.
Exactly like that.
We had a massive title sponsor at this particular time in World Wrestling Federation history. Stridex Supersize Pads, complete with the in-arena blimp.
Yeah.
For the pimply population that was watching the WWF at the time. Stridex felt that their pads would be a great crossover using WWF programming.
How come you don't hear about these pads anymore? These like Oxy or Stridex even? Like,
you don't see a whole lot of commercials anymore for
acne.
Yeah,
I mean,
maybe this has gone away.
No, it's the what is that thing? The Jennifer Love Hewitt one. What was that one? The really popular one. The one
clean
with the infomercials.
And clear?
No, the one with. Oh, okay, no. What am I thinking of? Acne medication. Acne medication. No, there's a really like popular one on the infomercials. Oh, fuck. Okay, you continue.
Okay. Well, you look this up. They announced a
crowd. Accutane.
Accutane?
Yeah, Accutane. Isn't that a thing?
Probably. That sounds like a...
Accutane.
Pimple solution?
Anyway, we should really, like, stick to a clock or something.
No, this shows. Is fine.
But, yeah, I don't know. Is skin just healthier today?
Yeah, probably. Probably as a result of so many youth growing up on this particular product and... Stridex, they overperformed. I mean, really, what a stupid invention to come up with. Something to cure an imperfection.
Not stupid. Brilliant.
Well, if everyone ends up using your product, there won't be any more skin issues.
So what are you saying? Medicine shouldn't be created at all?
No, I'm just saying for something like Stridex Supersize, Pat, you don't hear about them anymore. acne issues have gone down, then great, you did your job. Yeah. But at the end of the day, I don't need you anymore.
The hope is, though, is that...
It's like if everyone behaved.
That's ridiculous, John.
How many cops would be out of work? Like, listen, crime's down to such a degree.
Well, this is the argument of the medical profession in general. I mean, some say that a cure for cancer might already exist, but the companies don't want to publicize it.
Do you believe in that conspiracy?
I don't know what I believe. I never really thought about it.
Another thing to ponder in the shower next time.
Yeah, I will.
The crowd is listed at 18,062. Our announcers are Vince McMahon and Jerry Lawler. And we're going to have vignettes throughout the evening from Dean Douglas, mm-hmm. who is off in his satellite classroom.
I love these 90s shows. I really do because, you know, I grew up with this period. And because it just contains so many terrible gimmicks that nobody ever goes back to look at, featuring a lot of performers that I think would go on or at least started off, you know, being known as completely different other things. But here, you get to see Dean Douglas somehow go from being the guy who helped start the ECW revolution.
Threw the title down.
To this.
Dean Douglas.
Yeah.
And he has his nails across the chalkboard with, like, the sound effect over top. And gives us the definition of Dean, and he's going to be conducting summer school at SummerSlam. He will be critiquing the matches.
Mm-hmm.
I am convinced, and especially by the climactic angle involving Dean Douglas on this show, that this character was totally an inside joke on people that covered wrestling.
Hmm.
It was the idea that here is this nerd that's going to critique wrestling matches.
I would have actually...
Which is how Razor Ramon positioned him when he confronted him.
Perhaps. You could be. There could be something there. I thought this was probably, like, it didn't really hit that note for me, you know? If they wanted to make it like a Dave Meltzer, you know, type of character, I think they could have been a lot more blatant with it. This guy...
Star ratings.
Yeah, totally. This guy was more... what Matt Stryker was as well, you know, the teacher. Like, everybody has to have a job. This guy was a teacher. He knew big words, and he liked to define big words.
We start things off, early Vladimir spotting in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
As the 1-2-3 kid comes out and high fives Vladimir, getting set for his match with Hakushi. That would kick things off. Hakushi... into his WWF run at this point in time.
Yeah, earlier in the day, they showed us a clip on the pre-show.
Well, from it was their syndicated show, The Action Zone.
Okay.
Which would air in the afternoon.
Was it live?
No, it was always a taped show.
Okay.
Yeah, where Hakushi ran into Skip on the apron and got pinned by Barry Horowitz. So Hakushi had his match with Horowitz. He was
and he lost.
Deprived of a victory over one Barry Horowitz.
Yeah, Hakushi, who, you know, I think North Americans will remember from this run, but I remember more fondly from Michinoku Pro,
Jinsei Shinzaki.
Yeah, just or even ECW. I mean, just a guy with such a fucking cool look. You know, the tattoos. The fake tattoos.
Which never smudged, which never...
Yeah, some crazy type of roll-on ink. Maybe it was, what do you call that?
Henna?
Not henna, but it could have been henna, but it could have been the peel-off tattoos, the temporary tattoos.
That would suck. that you had to put on like 60 of these?
I don't know. I don't know. I've always wondered how this guy got that getup on. And like, because guaranteed there's not one dude writing each of those characters out, you know, in perfect lining every single time. It's got to be some type of roll-on thing.
One of those great wonders of forgettable 90s characters.
We'll never know. But, you know, a really cool entrance, like you'll see on this show.
Had ditched his manager by this point as well, Shinja.
Oh, I don't remember that.
He came out and he was just like, he had this nicely parted black hair and white powder all over his face.
Okay.
Or white paint.
Okay. But like this all-white robe, the white hat, and the music, it was like really cool. It was like an almost Undertaker-like entrance. Except for, you know, for a guy that jobs to Barry Horowitz on the pre-show.
Other than that.
Yeah.
Vince McMahon with an early candidate for line of the night.
Hakushi with his very first, and another chop there. Hakushi's very first SummerSlam. Let me try that again. SummerSlam appearance. Oh, my goodness.
SummerSlam.
SummerSlam.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a great bloopers release of SummerSlam.
He must have been so pissed off at himself. Like,
he was yelling at himself in his ear.
Yeah.
There's a handspring back elbow to the 1-2-3 kid. What a name, the 1-2-3 kid.
Sure.
That's lame after like three times you say it.
Yeah. The ABC kid.
The ABC kid. Yeah. The near fall kid.
He's so youthful. He just learned how to count.
From there was a spin kick to the jaw, and kid goes to the floor, and Hakushi proceeds to hit the Sasuke special to the floor.
Yes.
How often have you ever seen this move in the 90s, any time in the WWF?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is just an incredible move to watch, which I think the J-Cup the prior year, this was the spot in wrestling, but so few could do this.
Yeah, man. Like, watching Hakushi in this match, I was really impressed by him. And I of course, you know, anytime we've reviewed a Sean Waltman match in the past, on this show, he's always impressed. You know, he's a very consistent and I'll definitely say underrated worker because of, you know, how lame his gimmick eventually got.
He's always overlooked because of the X-Pac character. And I think a lot of that is kind of people just piling on with their memories rather than what was actually there. I mean, he was not a compelling character by 2000. At the same time, he was always very good.
Yes.
And in 95, when creative was totally in the shitter, some of their undercard guys and some of the talent they had in 95 was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And this show outlined the good and the bad. So anyway, that was a big spectacular spot from Hakushi, who then missed with a top rope headbutt. Kid drop kicks him to the floor and springs off the turnbuckle with a cross body to the floor. Then Kid hits a frog splash for a two count. He goes for a spinning heel kick, gets caught, and slammed down and pinned by Hakushi at 9 minutes and 27 seconds.
I thought it was a cool match, and I really saw this as a showcase for Hakushi, who I think with his offense that I think today would really fit in with the style of guys like Cesaro or Bryan Danielson, you know. I thought he really impressed in this match. He really got the crowd. And this match was a good surprise on a show that was headlined by Nash and Mabel. I didn't expect to see this.
This is one of the better matches on the show, mm-hmm. No doubt. Doc Hendricks is in the back with Mabel. Low angle shot, and Hendricks' gimmick is he's on crack or something. He's just like super wired.
Mm-hmm.
And Mabel refers to Diesel as Big Daddy Fool. And he has a surprise for Diesel later on. A surprise that would actually like never take place.
The surprise was, well, let me try to think what the surprise was. That match, we'll talk more about.
Hunter Hearst Helmsley, the Greenwich Snob, was in the second match of the pay-per-view against Bob Spark Plug Holly in a tribute to 1995 match.
This is exactly what I mean when I say I really like watching shows from this era, because I think we both remember these two, or we both know these two, and when we think of these two, we don't necessarily think of this version of themselves. And here, I feel like it's been a long time since we've seen a Blue Blood Hunter Hearst Helmsley match.
And Bob Holly's hair, which accompanied him to the ring.
Oh, yeah.
This sparky, hair sparky. Looked like he had driven around a race car track without
it was run over
a helmet on.
The front was definitely run over, leaving the back.
Helmsley is undefeated here after recently debuting in the company. He was just part of a slew of guys that came in with these ridiculous gimmicks. This was T.L. Hopper, the goon.
Oh, T.L. Hopper is, I think, who I was thinking of with the chocolate.
If I'm not mistaken, the free-for-all of this show was... maybe it was another SummerSlam, but I'm pretty sure it was a SummerSlam, 95 or 96, where it was the chocolate bar in the pool. The
fish out.
It could have even been on this show for all I know. Anyway, Triple H does the Tetsuya Naito gimmick where he takes his time to take off his clothes after the bell rings. And Hunter is begging off after a body slam and then takes a cheap shot at Holly and knocks him down, drops Holly on the top rope, and then rocks Holly into the corner with an Irish whip that just shakes the corner.
Yeah, really cool. I mean, really cool, you know, a spot that was just very simple. You know, just a typical Irish whip, but right into the corner,
chest
really
first
hard.
Bumps into the corner, the crowd would always react to it.
Yeah, because it makes such a loud smacking sound.
And then Vince says that the British Bulldog has arrived, but he's not scheduled to be here as they show him in the back arriving. And this would be the last time we would see the British Bulldog.
Oh, this was his last appearance until...
No, I'm saying on the show.
Oh, on the show.
He arrived, and we never saw him again. He was just...
Yeah, that was
He just
odd.
Showed up. It was like we were teasing some... Because he had just turned heel on Raw, turning on Diesel, but then never got involved in the main event.
Maybe that was a surprise.
That was a surprise. Teasing something and not delivering it.
That was Mabel's surprise, yes.
So... there's an abdominal stretch. Hunter grabs the rope. Vince is calling for a disqualification based on this. Holly reverses, then gets hip-tossed over the top to the floor. Holly comes back, hits a DDT, and Vince doesn't want to see the pedigree because it's so devastating. And Holly fires up. Hunter's begging off, blocks a back body drop, and he pedigrees Holly and pins him at 7 minutes and 12 seconds. And Hunter's career would go upwards.
As a result, direct result of this match, yes. You know, the pedigree, I think, has always been a cool finisher. You know, it's always looked good. It's always been believable. And I think it's a testament to the fact that this guy for 20 years has had that same finisher.
With that name.
Yeah, with that name, I think it's great. I think I have a much higher appreciation for Triple H's psychology and his expertise watching, you know, this show now as an adult. Like, it's clear at this point, even, this guy was...
He was very good.
Very good. Good psychology, good execution of his offense. He just seemed very well-rounded, with the only thing holding him back at this point being a pretty corny gimmick. You know, not unlike... like you think about a lot of guys on the roster today, like people like Fandango, who I'm sure are actually very technically skilled, but a stupid gimmick holding them back.
Then they showed highlights of the Stridex War on the Water with firefighters and WWF wrestlers in a tug of war. We just casually see the mayor of Pittsburgh chatting with Bam Bam Bigelow, and the WWF wrestlers won. Preserving kayfabe at the time. I mean, that would have been a pretty damaging piece of footage to air if the firefighters beat the big pro wrestlers.
Yes, it would be.
And the firefighters had to dive into the water for their loss.
No, the wrestlers dove in the water, didn't they?
No, were the firefighters.
Oh, okay,
they lost.
Okay.
That was part of the stipulation.
Gotcha. Yeah, this was like really cheesy. Basically, if you're... Sorry, guys, you aren't on the card. You're going to take part in the tug of war.
Yeah, there was no... Think about that. Bam Bam Bigelow headlines WrestleMania with Lawrence Taylor, and he's promised all this big stuff afterwards, and he's not even part of SummerSlam.
No, you got,
there were a lot of guys. Bulldog, Luger, Bigelow, like major names that were not on the show. Sid as well.
Yeah. They won the tug of war, though.
Consolation prizes. Yeah. But two guys who did get checks for SummerSlam 1995 were the current TNA production company, Jacob and Eli Blue. The Harris brothers.
They're in TNA right now?
They are. Their production company is now the head production of TNA.
I didn't realize they went on.
It's called like AO1 Production.
Oh, wow. I didn't know these two. What do they do?
They're not on-air characters. They're just in charge of the production.
They're producers in the back.
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow, cool.
So that's what they're up to. You know what they use? Their favorite part?
A blue screen.
Fuck.
Yes.
Not your first radio. Damn, you're good.
Nice.
Against the Smoking Guns, Billy, Bart, and their horrible mullets. In particular, Billy.
Jesus, yes.
Who would imagine that 20 years later, here is Billy Gunn, one of the top trainers in their system, trainer on Tough Enough,
mm-hmm.
and he's still here 20 years later.
Future Hall of Famer, definitely, I'd say.
I'm sure he'll go in at some point.
As part of DX, yeah, for sure.
Probably. Uncle Zebekiah,
mm-hmm.
Dutch Mantel in the corner of the Blue Brothers. The Blue Brothers get the advantage on Billy. I cannot for the life of me tell the Blue Brothers apart. We'll go with Jacob or Eli.
You couldn't. Vince didn't even try either.
Like, they were pretty identical. There was nothing to distinguish the two.
The Harris Brothers, in general, I think they've always been pretty indistinguishable. But, like, I did notice they have tattoos. They actually had similar tattoos, but one was reversed on the other. Don't even bother.
You were clearly enthralled with this particular match. Billy did hit a rocker dropper, tagged in Bart. They're double-teaming one of the Blue Brothers. And then they come back, and they double-team Billy behind the referee's back. Billy's put in the Tree of Woe. They're stomping him down. He keeps kicking out. Vince thinks the referee was too slow on one of the counts, and the Blue Brothers already should have won this match. Then they hit a spinning facebuster. Billy does. Makes the tag to Bart. Slams both. Then eats a big boot. The Blue Brothers run into each other. Tag to Billy. Bart holds one of them on the top rope for the leg drop. And Billy pins him at 6 minutes and 11 seconds. Not a whole lot to this.
No, I mean, the Harris Brothers or the Blue Brothers, they just wrestled a very basic heavyweight style. Nothing very special at all. But it's not like they were atrocious here. They were just passable and seemed like they might have fit in better in the 80s when everybody was like just basic heavyweight style. But I'd say in the 90s, like, this was kind of shitty. But and I'll also say, like, Billy definitely seemed like the standout, you know, of the four here. He was definitely the more...
that's some praise.
Well, listen to me. Like, he at least seemed to be the more flashy of him and Bart, you know. Bart seemed like the more ground-based technical guy, whereas Billy would be the one, like, kind of jumping around, doing a lot more faster stuff.
We had a video on Barry Horowitz, identified as a journeyman for years, who had just recently achieved his first WWF victory, upsetting Skip. They show a Body Donna's vignette on a TV set that had the logo below Zony. Z-O-N-Y.
Oh, no way. I didn't catch that. Maybe they got it in Chinatown.
Horowitz beat Skip during an Action Zone match. Then he lasted 10 minutes on a Superstars match. And then we get the line, now it's their chance to stride X out that imperfection.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. What product integration.
Yeah, Horowitz, I mean, I think this is like sort of the classic jobber underdog storyline. I mean, I feel like to this day, Barry Horowitz still gets referenced as a classic example of a jobber getting a push. You know, like to the point where Action Bronson has a song about him, Barry Horowitz. And he was very over with this crowd.
He was. First, Skip came out, Chris Candido, alongside Sonny, who just cuts a promo on their way to the entrance. Sonny was a great talker.
Fucking great. Yeah.
Like, she was tremendous in this role.
Yeah. And she was only, like, 22, 23
She was
at
super
this time.
Young at this point in 1995.
But just so charismatic. And, of course, she looked amazing, too.
So we have Skip and Barry Horowitz, who comes out to music that you would hear at a bar mitzvah.
That was like, that's the thing about Barry Horowitz that I didn't seem to recollect was the fact that he was basically a stereotypical Jewish character. It wasn't necessarily a fact that they promoted in this push, but certainly in the packaging of the music and him coming, like, his matchup board photo was of him.
With these terrible glasses.
These hipster glasses that, like, Martin Scorsese wears. Like, it's trying to be like, you know, hey, this guy's Jewish. Like, he was essentially working something.
I think he had, like,
character.
Some pens in his, like, breast pocket. It was just,
I don't know.
He looked like a computer technician.
Yeah.
So Skip and Barry Horowitz. Horowitz comes out, and because it's his first pay-per-view match that I'm aware of, celebrated it with these goofy suspenders, which snapped off right away, and he just tossed them off.
Yeah, again, that might have been part of the attempt at the Jewish look. You know, whatever that means.
Suspenders.
Yeah.
So anyway, he ditches them within a minute. He rolls up Skip, but then Horowitz gets sent through the ropes, and then a vertical suplex sends Skip from the ring to the floor. Typically, this is the spot where it's like you block it to avoid going to the floor. They just hit it. And this would be the first of two of these on the show.
Yeah, we did.
One which would be more devastating than the other. And Sunny then gets into the ring. She's livid about this and gets thrown out by Earl Hebner.
Doesn't she at least actually try to throw in the
towel? She tries to throw in the towel for them to do a spoof on Mike Tyson and Peter McNeely. Vince says, this isn't boxing. This isn't Tyson McNeely.
I see.
So anyway, that was kind of what they were playing off of.
Well, aren't you allowed to throw in the towel, though, in a wrestling
Yes, you are.
So how does the ref not allow this to happen?
I don't know. I guess Sunny had, after one vertical suplex, she was ready to give up on Chris Candido. Sunny trips Horowitz, and Skip gets the advantage, hits a leg drop off the second turnbuckle. There was a chant of Barry. And then they brought up Siskel and Ebert, two famous movie reviewers who did not like one another. And
I didn't know that they didn't like each other.
Oh, they hated each other.
Oh, wow.
If you go watch some of their... There is an outtake. It's a very famous YouTube clip of the two in-between commercials or in-between hits and are just being so, like, just passive-aggressive to one another, just insulting each other. It wasn't even passive. They did not like each other. And I watched this very fascinating documentary on Roger Ebert recently. But anyway, Vince is making a pitch that if Siskel and Ebert ever were to have a match, they would have to do it in the World Wrestling Federation. Like, it would have to be here.
Hmm.
So I imagine this was at the height of some issue between the two, or it was very well known, at least at 1995, that these two fucking hated one another. Vince says there is talk that if Barry Horowitz wins this match, he could actually get a contract with the WWF.
So what's he doing now? Freelancing?
I guess he's just an independent contractor on a per-night basis. There's a Thez press from Horowitz, but Skip immediately then hits a power slam, does some jumping jacks, and high-fives Sonny. Skip, clearly a fan of New Japan's junior heavyweight division, you could tell, based on some of his offense here and just certain spots he was doing, which this was 1995. I'm sure there were a lot of guys influenced. Skip climbs up, gets drop-kicked and crotched on the top. There's a reverse elbow to Horowitz, a diving headbutt, but then pulls up Horowitz as he's going for the cover. A pile driver is countered with a back body drop, and then as Horowitz climbs up, Sonny shakes the ropes, Horowitz falls down, and Skip hits a superplex when Hakushi comes down, and Skip had cost him the match with Horowitz earlier in the day, and he distracts Skip by springboarding across the ring, not making contact with anybody, just flying through the ring, and allowed Barry Horowitz to apply an inside cradle and pin Skip in 11 minutes and 21 seconds.
Yeah. I was, like, definitely kind of annoyed by that they had Hakushi drop out to Barry Horowitz earlier in the day. But, you know, seeing the full story of basically the two of them costing the other a match against Barry Horowitz, somehow it kind of makes it okay. You know, and it's not like they're not like main eventers either.
Hakushi and Chris Candido would have been a very good match in 1995.
Didn't they go on to have that?
Oh, yeah, they go on after this, but I'm saying what they were setting up.
I was actually quite impressed with Barry Horowitz here. I thought he played a really good baby face. He was working a lot faster, and like he was actually entertaining, whereas Candido I was actually more disappointed by in this match. I thought he was a little boring. And I know the point is to probably slow down the pace, but I thought his stuff just was too slow.
Yeah, this was kind of the peak of Barry Horowitz's career. I mean, he'd stick around a little bit afterwards, but nothing as high profile as this Skip feud. I mean, he was kind of just thrown into... You know, he would have some more appearances over the next year and a half. Then he went to WCW for a while as just, again, enhancement talent. And that was largely it for his career. He was just kind of career journeyman. And if you have to look at his... This was probably his most high-profile match of his career was this SummerSlam match. Then we had a not-so-high-profile match. It was Alundra Blaze defending her women's title against Bertha Faye. What a Divas Revolution this was. Really empowering women out everywhere through the Bertha Faye character.
We had a brief Dean Douglas segment, too, between this.
Oh, that's right. We went to the satellite classroom with Dean, who defined the word vivify. Vivify. And says that Hakushi gave Barry the opportunity to vivify, and it's horrible. He gives the referee an F, and Horowitz gets an S for slacker.
These were fucking, like, really bad. But you can't say that the guy didn't try, you know, Shane Douglas here. And you can't say that he can't speak. Because, like, he's given, a really stupid gimmick. But, you could tell at least the guy could talk, and especially doing this live. He did this like right after the end of the match, showing a clip of the last replay.
Right.
So I think even, you know, you have to respect that ability, but unfortunately it was wasted on a stupid gimmick like
and
this.
A character just going nowhere. Todd Pettengill is then in the locker room, and they show highlights of the first ladder match involving Razor Ramon and Shawn Michaels from WrestleMania 10. And Michaels comes in for the interview, says it's impossible to prepare for this type of a match, and there are only two men that can do this type of match. He has everything to lose as champion, says he has nothing in his life except for this Intercontinental title. Could you imagine this line flying in 2015? Ryback to say, I've got nothing going on in my life except for this title. This yeah. Intercontinental title. That's he says that nothing will stop him. He will be known as the greatest Intercontinental champion of all time. And Michaels just walks off as if this interview was the biggest chore in the world, as Todd is throwing the Vince, and the look on Michaels' face of just, stop wasting my time.
I was like,
a baby face, too.
Yeah, that's what I was very confused by, because in my memory, Michaels was always heel. And like his mannerisms on the show,
acted like a dick in this interview.
Certainly, were a little confusing. You know, by the time I finished, I went to the match later on in the show.
Then we go to Alundra Blaze and Bertha Faye for the women's championship. Jerry Lawler saying that when Whippleman first saw Bertha, he lost control of all bodily functions.
Yes,
wonderful.
There was just—I mean, Bertha Faye basically was here for the fat jokes.
Like, that was it.
Yes.
That was it. And
I mean, the
odd couple pairing with Harvey Whippleman.
Yes, like, I just, this would be offensive as hell today. But, like, in the mid-90s, I don't think it was just funny.
I bet there's a lot of fans that simply only know Bertha Faye for this miniature run. But Rhonda Singh was, like, a really talented worker that had some tremendous matches in Japan and could go. And
she looked like fast.
She was. Yeah. I mean, she was deceptively good for it. I mean, if you just judge her on how she looked, she was very good. But it was pure comedy that she was brought into the WWF, which, I mean, they moved around this women's division a lot. I mean, you had, as they mentioned here, Alundra winning the title back from Bull Nakano, and they brought in a lot of the women from Japan, but it just didn't click. And then they went this direction with Bertha Faye. Anyway, the announcer, when Alundra comes out, she comes out with this big pyro entrance, and the announcer says, "He weighs," and gives the weight, and Vince immediately corrects the announcer, who was not Howard Finkel. It was this other guy that they briefly had that I don't even know the name of. And, I mean, he says he weighs, and then goes to announce Alundra Blaze. It was just, I don't know, I guess like a brain fart. McMahon refers to Bertha's outfit as garish, and then Lawler notes that instead of buns of steel, Bertha has buns of cinnamon. Get it? Faye keeps knocking her down, hits a leg drop to Alundra. The crowd is only into the power spots, misses a splash off the second turnbuckle, and then it's Alundra with a Toyota roll for a two count, and then applies knees from an extremely loose clinch. Harvey then distracts the referee as Blaze takes her down, face first, three times, and chases after Harvey. There was a really bad crucifix application by Blaze for a two count. Hurricane Rana, and then a two on top by Blaze. Then hits a pair of missile drop kicks. The final one misses, and then there's a sit-out powerbomb by Bertha Faye, who pins Alundra as Alundra gets her shoulder up right at the end.
No, she got it up before three for
well,
sure.
Well, I think she was doing the old, like, getting it up to try and save face when she was losing. But you're right. It was, like, totally a botched finish.
Yeah.
And Bertha wins the title. It only went 4:39. Not a good match by any stretch. I thought this was one of the weakest on the show, and it was just played for comedy. I don't know how you could really take any of this seriously.
Did you expect the title change?
Watching this now?
No, I mean, like,
oh, at the time?
Like, did the title change make sense to you?
I mean, Alundra Blaze's contract was coming due a few months later, and they were not planning to renew it. So I'm sure they were planning to take the title off Alundra at some point. And then December, she would win the title back. That's the thing. So I think at this point, they were still at least gung-ho on doing something with her, because they put the title back on her, and then in December she'd show up on Nitro with it. So this was only going to be a short reign. But Jim Ross, whose sole appearance on this show was to interview Harvey and Bertha Faye in the aisle. And Harvey yells at Jim Ross to get her his hands off of Bertha, calls her a deserving princess, and Harvey and Bertha Faye can go down in history as the only couple to hold the women's title in the WWF. Remember Harvina?
Oh, right.
And Bertha says that she will put the shiny title around her slim, fast waist. What a role model. And then we go to the history of The Undertaker and Kama, going back to WrestleMania. It's been a run-on sentence, Way.
What do you mean?
A run-on sentence with Kama.
Oh.
And the build-up to this match...
That's very good.
...looks like shit. We had all of Kama's matches, these wreaths, these black wreaths would show up at ringside.
From Taker's creatures.
Creatures of the night, which constituted white makeup and black Levi's jeans.
Basically, like, it gave the impression that, like...
Holy shit.
Undertaker hangs out with, you know, these corny goth kids. Like, probably writing poetry and, like, listening to The Cure.
For whatever reason. Also in this time, Kama had stolen the urn and melted it down into a gold chain.
Yeah.
Like a step up from, like, Quentin Rampage Jackson's chain. This is gold.
What do you do with the ashes if you're melting down the urn?
I don't know. That's a great question. Probably embed them into the
chain. Damn.
So Gorilla Monsoon makes the only suitable stipulation that you can when there's Creatures of the Night and Black Death wreaths being presented on his television. He made this a casket match. And then we got a Coliseum home video exclusive, which I guess isn't an exclusive anymore with the WWE Network.
No.
With The Undertaker and Paul Bearer, Taker promises death and that the final sand in the hourglass will come down. This was actually a very good promo by Paul Bearer and The Undertaker.
Sounded like
their characters.
A vintage Taker promo.
Unfortunately, we then had a match involving Kama and The Undertaker, which, if I did not watch this during the same week as that Los Villanos match, this would have been one of the worst matches I can say I've ever seen.
It's not a good match.
This was, hands down, I thought the worst match of SummerSlam 95. Kama gets tossed over the
top. I don't know about that.
You don't think I...
Dude, the fucking main event was pretty bad.
We're going to have a debate.
Okay.
Kama gets tossed over the top and lands on the casket. Of course, he's an opponent of The Undertaker, so he's got to be scared of the casket. And being into closed spaces, he's claustrophobic now. There is also a camera inside of the casket.
I know, before GoPros.
This was revolutionary stuff in 1995. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there was something resembling a clothesline off the top by Kama, but I will not give it credence to call it as such. He slams Taker down. He rises up. Taker's sent into the casket. He stands up and pulls Kama over the top. But DiBiase, who's in the corner of Kama, distracts and allows Kama to get out. Kama gets the heat, sends Taker over the top, and Paul Bearer just gets pissed at one point, taking his jacket off and going after DiBiase.
DiBiase, who... I just didn't even realize he was even in this match until that one...
He was in Kama's corner.
Yeah.
Taker is run into the post back first, and then Taker is suplexed on top of the casket. Kama goes for a pile driver on the casket, but Taker sends him back into the ring with a back body drop. Kama goes to kick the head like a field goal kick and lands on his ass missing. Perfect metaphor for this entire match. Taker then clotheslines Kama, both go over the top and into the casket, and we go to the dark shot of the camera because the casket is closed. Kama tries to crawl out. He's pulled back in. The purple siding of the casket is falling off here. Both get out. There's a spinning neck breaker to Taker, the spinning neck Taker, and then Taker comes back, hits a choke slam. To their credit, the crowd was very much into the tombstone tease, and Taker finally hitting it and rolling Kama in. The problem was, he rolled him into the casket at 16 minutes and 26 fucking seconds. And Vince, in the ultimate credibility killer, called this a phenomenal match.
That is
ludicrous. Yeah. Even in mid-90s play-by-play WWF standards. God, did this suck.
This match was not good. I'm in complete agreement there. Kama's offense is just the most basic punching and kicking, headlocks. And Taker at this point was still working his zombie style, so everything he did was very slow. It makes me wonder when they decided to bring back the Deadman character in the 2000s, if they had an idea to bring back this style too, or if Taker just thought, you know, fuck that, I want to work like a, you know, normal person.
To everyone that looks at the WrestleMania streak, and especially the last number, but I mean, and this goes to the early WrestleMania matches. Look at some of the shit matches Undertaker has had at SummerSlams, like Kamala, Giant Gonzalez, The Undertaker versus Undertaker, this turd. Yeah. Other ones, what other ones come to mind for me? There was a crappy tag match in 99.
Did you say Bundy, Nash?
Oh, those were WrestleMania matches. I'm talking about SummerSlam matches.
Oh.
Like, he had some god-awful SummerSlam matches.
Yeah, well, I mean, like,
JBL in Toronto.
How many great matches from that era from The Undertaker could you think of?
There weren't too many.
Prior to, like, Michaels, you know.
And he was paired with the Freaks.
Yeah, exactly. That was one of the biggest problems. I'm sure, you know, his limiting style working the way like this probably didn't help things either. And I hate casket matches anyway.
I do, too.
They're just not a visually pleasing gimmick, not like a ladder match or a cage match. I mean, you know, those matches, you have dudes falling off of ladders and like climbing to the top of a cage. It's visually pleasing. This is just a lid closing on a box, you know? Like, I understand it works for the gimmick, but like, how about like something like cooler, like a cremation match?
Well, that's kind of a loser leaves life match.
Yeah, I'd like that. But that said, this crowd,
they did get into the finish.
Loved The Undertaker.
But let us not overlook the fact that Kama sucked, period.
Yeah, not the same without the hose.
Then we got a video on another atrocious program. Maybe the worst usage of Bret Hart in his career was this several-month period in 1995 where he went from a Kiss My Foot program with Jerry Lawler to a fight with a fucking dentist to then a feud with Jean-Pierre Lafitte over his leather jacket being stolen. I don't think, my God, did Bret earn that fucking title by Survivor Series after the shit he had to go through in mid-1995. And this was maybe the peak of it.
I want to introduce to you my very own personal dentist. He don't believe in painless dentistry, and he's going to show the Hitman that tonight. Come on, you morons. Make him
welcome. Oh, my goodness.
Here he is.
We know very little about Isaac Yankum. Listed at 6 feet 10 inches and weighing in approximately 300 plus pounds, Isaac Yankum from Decatur, Illinois. You look like Decatur, Illinois. I got a question for you.
What's that?
How could a dentist have teeth this rotten?
That's the sacrifice that this man makes to show all of these little idiots out there what can happen to you if you don't brush after every meal, if you don't floss regularly. He makes that sacrifice to show as an example to all of these little rotten teeth idiots that you see here at ringside.
They showed a video on the whole feud with Lawler going back over 2 years at this point to the first King of the Ring in 93. Lawler got his revenge after losing the Kiss My Foot match.
And prior to that, he had Bob Backlund, too.
Oh, that horrible WrestleMania match. 95 is not a great year for Bret Hart.
Did he wrestle Backlund at WrestleMania?
This 95, yeah.
Wow.
That was the same year, that submission match that he hated.
No, that wasn't Mania, though. That was like,
that was WrestleMania. Bret and Backlund?
Not the tall one.
Sorry, there was the...
With Helen.
There was the Survivor Series, but then they had the rematch at WrestleMania, which was the I Quit match.
Because I liked that submission, like that the Helen Hart one a lot.
The Helen Hart... Oh, yeah, that one. I'm talking about WrestleMania, where they had Bret get his win back. Mm. Anyway, in this video recap, where they show Lawler having to kiss his own foot, the voiceover by Todd Pettengill is that Lawler tasted his own puppies as well.
Which doesn't really mean the same thing.
It has a whole different meaning today than it did in 1995. So what does the king do after kissing his own foot? He recruited his dentist with some of the worst vignettes ever. This is a character that does not get slammed enough.
Some of the best vignettes, you mean?
Oh, my God. Where he is, like, literally perform like, a malpractice suit in action here as he's tearing out teeth from patients, including one bloody tooth that is so severe it's censored on television and on the screen here. So many tooth puns in this video by Todd Pettengill. And then Lawler is in the ring to introduce Yankum from Decatur, Illinois.
Brilliant.
Even I shook my head in sheer embarrassment.
No, I love it. Decatur.
I guess if you're going to go an 8 on the scale of lame, what's stopping you from a 10? And that's what this was with this character.
This would have won an award at the pun competition.
No. This interview with Brett would have.
Oh, okay.
Where Todd Pettengill sets up Brett by saying that Jerry Lawler has been drilling this message into the fans' heads and extracting revenge. It's your turn to shut the mouth of Jerry Lawler. To which Bret Hart replies, "Listen, you big tooth fairy." And the best words to ever come out of Bret's mouth, "I don't care if you're a dentist. You bring your accomplishments in the dental field."
He says, "I don't care, Jerry Lawler, if you bring your chiropractor to me. I'll take them all out."
And he's going to knock Yankum's teeth out the old-fashioned way.
I really would have loved to know what was going through Brett's mind when he was presented with this gimmick. You know, how do you go from winning the belt at WrestleMania a year and a half ago to feuds with dentists?
And look at the guys he worked throughout 94. I mean, Brett, he's working with... You know, it was all, like, serious programs. And, like, God, was 95 a year that you kind of overlook of the shit that Brett was given.
It's incredible. But at the same time, I watch these matches with a real curiosity, especially a match like this, because I just see them like as almost challenges to see what Bret Hart could come up with. I mean, I took like the even some of the Yokozuna matches like that. I took the Kevin Nash match like that. And
look at the matches he pulled out of guys.
Great matches.
That's why when you throw... I mean, the joke on Kane, you know, later in his career was that, you know, him and Billy Gunn, those were the only guys Benoit couldn't get a good match out of. And eventually he did get a good one out of Kane. He never did with Billy Gunn. But that was kind of the appeal to me of any Bret match was when he was so limited mm-hmm. with his opponent. Especially Isaac Yankum in 1995.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, here's a guy that is relatively young. I mean, mid-20s at this point. Mm-hmm. Had come over from Smoky Mountain. And, I mean... This guy had a great look, mm-hmm. a fantastic look with a terrible, terrible gimmick.
Great look. His body looked great. But I think we all remember Isaac Yankum for the bad fake teeth. But what about that hair? Like,
I thought it was awesome.
Talk about the Bob Holly mullet. Like, this was just a curly, nasty, like, thing. Why would you spend that much time on your body but walk out with a fat thing on your head?
It was 1995, boy. That's the only excuse you need. And Vince McMahon, who just had some dynamite calls. The bell rings, and Vince's first words, "Wait no longer. Oh, thank God we're here." Bret, Yankum won.
Isaac Yankum, though, had... Did you notice his entrance music?
It was...
the sound of teeth drilling. I thought that was brilliant. Like, there's more...
Nails on chalkboards, yeah. Drilling teeth. God, they were creatively bankrupt in 1995.
No, I like...
My God, should they have been thanking Nitro for coming along. Kicking them in the ass as they so appropriately needed. How about Yankum's, I mean, the original blue pants in the WWF?
Hmm.
These blue pants were something else.
That's what dentists wear, right?
Sure, sure. He was like, he should have just wore all scrubs, mm-hmm. I guess. Yankum is on offense from the start, and Hart comes back, clotheslines him to the floor, and then from the second turnbuckle, Yankum starts the sharpshooter from being applied. And Yankum then Irish whips Hart chest first into the turnbuckle and then clotheslines Hart to the floor, making the motion to the crowd, he's going to yank a tooth out. It's time to take out the teeth. Hart gets draped on the top rope, and Kane hits a leg drop from the top rope. Maybe the most athletic spot Glenn Jacobs has ever performed in a WWF ring.
Hits it, but I wouldn't say he really connected with it.
Well, this was no less a guillotine leg drop.
Yes, it was.
Glenn Jacobs.
And I don't think, I mean, to me, the appeal of this guy, you know, all limitations in ring aside, you can't argue that he wasn't agile for his size.
Oh, I don't doubt it. I mean, listen, I wouldn't have advised this guy to keep this leg drop in his arsenal in 1995.
No, you're not a fan of leg drops.
No,
from the top rope.
They're very stupid to make part of your regular routine that people expect from you that you've got to do in every match. It's just, it's dumb. But look at the longevity this guy has gotten out of this character, which he has made the most out of the least at times.
You're talking about Kane, not this Yankum.
Which Lawler continually noted, it's pronounced Yankum, not Yankum.
Yeah,
that was very important for him to distinguish throughout this match. Yankum goes to the floor, and Hart connects with a suicide dive. The best part about this suicide dive was that they shot it from the hard camera, which to me looked so much more impressive than the usual cameraman at ringside.
Always. Yeah.
This looks so much more spectacular, and you never see it from this angle.
Well, I always think about this stuff. I mean, just simply as a cameraman, and whenever you're doing like a high spot, you know, you want to convey the distance, and to do that, to have somebody travel along the X axis instead of like the Z axis, you know what I mean?
Of course,
you can convey that a lot better. But I think, you know, like to have somebody pop right into your screen too is a cool visual as well. But I feel like anytime you do like have a guy doing like a shooting star press or something, it's always better to me on the wide shot.
And you can always do the replay of another angle. I thought this looked great. So anyway, it continues on here. Brett follows with a bulldog in the ring for a two count. Hart goes through his typical closing sequence and gets the sharpshooter applied when Lawler helps Yankum get to the bottom rope. Hart is distracted with Lawler, allowing a back body drop that sends Yankum to the floor. They're fighting. Hart sends him into the steps, and Vince is left alone on commentary as Lawler's getting involved here. Hart then tosses Yankum off the top, pulls him around the post, and ties this cable around his feet and starts stomping Yankum repeatedly. The biggest heat of this match was Brett finally going after Lawler in the match, which clearly was the match I think people wanted to see. Rather than the dentist.
That was the real feud here.
That was the heat, yes.
Yeah. Well, but they had already done it.
Well, then why are we going backwards here with the dentist?
He needed a mouthpiece.
Damn, you're on fire today. Mm. Yankum escapes from the cable tying and hits a double axe from the top to the floor. They're back in the ring. Lawler trips Hart. He goes after Lawler, and then Yankum attacks him from behind and ties up Hart in the ropes by the neck, and the DQ is called at 16 minutes and 9 seconds as they're yanking on his legs. They're yankuming his legs and apparently suffocating Brett in the ropes.
It's the same hanging spot that ripped off Foley's ear.
Yes.
In that match with Vader. And I think it looks really good. Like, even in close-up to this day, I still buy the spot of, like, a guy getting hung, you know, but with the ropes caught between his head. It just looks so uncomfortable. And the way they staged it here with everybody rushing to Brett's aid helped really sell it as well. But the match itself, unfortunately, was not very good. I mean, certainly Brett being here helped, but I wouldn't say he succeeded at all in getting a good match out of this guy.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to getting the most out of limited opponents, this was not one of Brett's better ones. I mean, when you watch it, what he got out of Kevin Nash, when you look at other big guys that he was able to really work around, yeah, this one never came close to that.
And Glenn Jacobs here was just definitely a lot more limited. You know, I think today he'd probably have a much different match with a Bret Hart in his prime. But here, he showed some promise in his agility, but was just very limited otherwise.
So, some horrendous characters the man would have to go through until Kane was born 2 years later. The officials tend to Bret, and as I said, they came back. They didn't go to this match at another pay-per-view or anything. This was the Yankum character stuck around for a little bit. Was not a big hit.
Did they have, like, TV matches, though, at least?
I'm sure they did TV matches. I can't recall off the top of my head. I don't think it was just dropped completely cold. Mm-hmm. And there was always that Brett Lawler kind of feuding, but this was kind of it for the feud. And I think a terrible waste of Bret Hart on a major pay-per-view.
That whole year.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the idea of, like, you know, some of the guys that weren't on this show. I mean, Christ, give me Brett and Bulldog after Bulldog just turned, or give me, Jesus, give me anything. But this was, you know, an idea of a storyline and sacrificing match quality for it. Doc Hendricks is with Razor Ramon in the back. And man, it's jarring at times to hear the heavy accent of Razor Ramon.
Definitely.
When you're so used to Scott Hall.
The Tony Montana voice.
Yeah. I mean, it felt like so cheesy watching this just in a bubble.
Cheesy, but like, the Razor Ramon character is such a slice of the 90s pro wrestling scene that to this day, like, I got a dude here, I got a producer here who always calls me Wazer Ramon. He calls me Wazer. Like, it annoys the shit out of me. But, like, you know, that's just my example of, like, how this character is so fondly remembered, it still gets brought up annoyingly with the pun of my name. So none of you guys better call me that.
Best waiting puns. No. There's a future thread.
Wazer.
Wazer Ramon. Is it Womone or Ramon?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
So Razor is saying how history does repeat itself. And as he's in mid-promo, Brett just walks right through the shot, selling. And it's clearly not meant to be anything. As Razor gives him a look and then just goes right back to his promo, not knowing what to do.
Obviously, it was intentional, though.
Was it?
Yeah, it had to be. Nobody just walks through a set, okay? Nothing.
Well, it's worth saying, though, where this was positioned. This was right in the gorilla position, because Razor, it was going to be one seamless shot.
But, dude, have you ever walked through a set in your life on TV? I don't care how injured you are. This was guaranteed intentional. Guaranteed.
Well,
it's just, if anything, just to sell, you know, Brett being injured.
Whatever it was. He walks through. Hendricks refers to Shawn Michaels as the evil Knievel of wrestling, and he says he leads if he is ready. If they decide to dance tonight, he's going to be the one leading, which would not be the case in the world of pro wrestling and who was leading who.
Yeah.
And I like this kind of shot where it went right from the interview to he turned and walked right out into the arena.
That was cool. Yeah.
And comes out, and we get Shawn Michaels, Razor Ramon, ladder match for the Intercontinental title. Which was very funny because these two, recently they came out with the Click DVD, and, you know, these guys have now...
Did you watch it?
I haven't seen the whole documentary, but they put on one of those 30-minute previews on the network, and I watched a little bit of it. And it's a cool scene. They have all five of them in a room together, essentially just, like, chatting away. It doesn't feel like a formal interview setting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they're all kind of assimilating now into veteran carnies. And it's like Michaels and Hall, they do the usual, like, yeah, everyone talks about that ladder match. Well, we probably did 300 better ones that same year. And it's like, you guys did at most 10 ladder matches in 94 total, including the WrestleMania match. But that grows to a ridiculous number. Nonetheless, that was such a famous match in 94. And they waited a year and a half to come back with it here. Now with it completely shifted, you had two baby faces. And now Shawn was the Intercontinental champion defending, whereas the last time it was Razor Ramon who was the champion against the guy who never lost his title in Shawn Michaels. So a bit of a different dynamic, and Michaels was clearly at this point one, if not number two, behind Bret Hart in terms of the guy in the company when it came to night in, night out performance.
In terms of work rate.
Yes.
Yes. It was confusing to me heading into this match because I completely forgot about Shawn's face turn after WrestleMania.
Yeah, where Sid turned on him and... Yeah, and this was Shawn now as the babyface, and this would go into the fall. This was pre the whole Syracuse bar incident and him going out with his post-concussion syndrome angle and leading up to WrestleMania the next year. Doc Hendricks has now replaced Lawler on commentary. I was not a fan of this change in commentary. Hendricks was not god-awful.
No.
But
I liked Lawler a lot at this time.
Oh, I did too. That's why I wasn't as big a fan. Doc Hendricks, in character, pretty grating, I've got to say.
He's just pretty, you know, he's like Michael Hayes, like the energy of Michael Hayes, but in a generic announcer.
They announced that the winner of this match will face Sid on the September 11th edition of Raw, because the next two Mondays, including the night after this, there would be no Raw. It got preempted for 2 weeks because of the Westminster Dog Show.
Of course.
The important one being the following week, where Nitro would debut unopposed.
Mm.
So the September 11th Raw, that would be the first head-to-head between Raw and Nitro, and using Michaels against Sid on that show. So the beginning of this match, the title gets hung, and they lift it up, and Shawn Michaels has a hissy fit and demands them take down the title so he can flip it around.
The title basically originally was hung with the face facing down towards the ring, and Michaels was complaining about, like, the match was just not starting. Like, the Michaels was just more like...
This was Shawn Michaels being Shawn Michaels in 1995.
It was a great sample of, like, the attitude of a 90s Shawn Michaels captured on tape, because Shawn was just basically complaining, they put it up wrong, I'm not starting this match until, you know, this thing gets fixed. So they take the time. Vince has to fill, you know, Vince's excuse was...
Well, Vince thought he was referring to it's too high. So you're going to have to get Andre the Giant with a jetpack to get that.
I don't know what Vince thought, but, like, that's what he said on commentary. So they lower the belt. And it wasn't even a big change. It was just basically Shawn fixed it himself. Jack Doan comes in.
Yes.
And then
his mullet.
Michaels just like fixes it himself and tells Doan to just shoo away. He looks pissed. And then they start the match.
I wonder if he thought the way it was angled that he was worried it was going to loosen and fall.
Possible, but I
think... if that was his case, I don't blame him. But it didn't seem like something that was such a...
Didn't seem like a big thing. Definitely not to get upset over on camera. At the same time, you could tell Shawn Michaels was a perfectionist, okay? And I think even visually, flipping the belt so that it faces the crowd instead of the bottom made for, like, better close-ups. It looked better. So he was right to get upset, but not, maybe not, you know. It was just a great sample of, like, an out-of-character Shawn Michaels getting upset about something.
Well, and, I mean, 95, 96, 97... These weren't rare occurrences. I mean, there were times he would just completely lose his shit during matches, and it was so evident that he would get so upset if something was going wrong.
Oh, like at the end of this match.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So the title is hung the right way, allowing the match to begin. They start very quick right away. Teases of the Sweet Chin Music and Razor's Edge with both blocking. And then... we get the vertical suplex as Razor sends Michaels over top to the floor as the back of Michaels' leg hits the barricade, which, mind you, were the steel barricades at the time, not the all-black barricades you're used to today. These were those steel things.
And
this looked brutal.
And he seemed to take most of the fall on his butt.
Yeah.
Like he didn't land on his feet like you see sometimes people take this bump.
This was the nuttiest bump of the entire show. Ramon hits a follow-away slam off the second turnbuckle. They show Sid watching in the back. I hope they didn't bring him all the way to Pittsburgh for this one cutaway.
I don't know, but talk about like a
letdown,
a come down after like this is your prize. Following this ladder match with Razor and Shawn is a match with Sid. Like, come on.
The ladder is brought into the ring. Michaels climbs and his tights are pulled down. It was a full moon in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, he...
Protein bar fell out, though.
Do you think they did that 300 times, that spot, the bare ass?
Oh, Michaels did this all the time. Yeah. This was like Rick Rude, Michaels, Flair. They love that ass spot.
Yeah.
Ramon shoves him, and the ladder falls with his left knee tied around one of the rungs, and they'd work over his knee.
I really like that. Something like so simple.
And Hendricks brought up immediately how that affects the super kick. Yeah. The best line from Hendricks on the show. Ramon goes after the bad knee, attacks it with the ladder over and over. Ramon gets sent ribs first into the ladder in the corner, but then goes back to attacking the knee, wraps it around the post. Michaels is climbing, and Michaels comes off the top turnbuckle to knock him off. Michaels selling was incredible during this match. He climbs the ladder, hits a moonsault off of it, then follows with a splash off the top of the ladder, missing Ramon. They both climb and fall off as the ladder tips over. So Ramon then brings in the standby ladder from underneath the ring. So we have two ladders. And he hits the Razor's Edge to Michaels off the ladder. Then they both climb. Michaels kicks Ramon off and jumps at the title, missing it. Michaels then counters a razor's edge with a back body drop, sending Ramon to the floor. And then Michaels, with Ramon laid out on the floor, climbs the ladder, goes to grab it, and it doesn't come down. But as he goes, he just, like, jumps off to expect to bring the title down with him, up empty.
He was clearly mispositioned on the ladder. Like, the ladder
maybe
was...
the title was shifted at a bad angle.
But, yeah, this was a botch.
He was so clearly annoyed by this and climbs back to take it.
Meanwhile, like, Razor is on the outside now for far too long. You know, he's like, you could tell the guy's awake, and he's like, he's very slowly trying to climb up into the ring, but not really.
Thank God they weren't doing, like, he's climbing after Sean.
Yeah, that would
fuck that up.
That would have been messy.
But sometimes you gotta improvise.
Definitely.
So, Michaels, on the second try, grabs it. This thing went 25 minutes, 3 seconds, and then Ramon instantly, grabs the title away from Sean, only to immediately hand it back to him and shake his hand. And
teasing a brief heel turn.
Teases it.
That's why I was, like, really confused here, because Sean, you know, between complaining about the belt not being hung up properly and everything, like, everything prior to the match showed that he was playing some type of a dickish heel. And but everything throughout the match showed that he was a babyface. And in the end, I realized this was a double babyface thing, but it was still a little confusing. But that said, great match, you know, a classic mid-90s Shawn Michaels match. And that's not to say that Razor didn't play his part either. Like, when he...
Most of the credit to Michaels.
Of course, absolutely. But it's not like Razor was Isaac Yankem here, you know? Like,
that's true.
When Razor had the heat, I thought his working of Shawn's knee was really good with a wide variety of moves. And probably, you know, one of the best matches... definitely one of the best matches of Hall's career.
Yeah, I mean, finish aside, I don't think it was that bad. I think people are watching closely and they can see something went wrong, that alters their whole view of something.
You're also comparing it to the WrestleMania 10 match, which was, I mean, near flawless. So
that was a great match. I honestly believe if you watch these two together, I mean, this match to me is just as spectacular. They did a lot more ambitious stuff in this one than the first one. It was so novel. It was so new that just doing anything involving a ladder was so radically different. This one had a lot more, I think, athletic spots out of Michaels. I like this one quite a lot.
Yeah.
This is one that doesn't get brought up as much as the first, obviously, but to me, really holds up.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed this a lot. Easily the best match on this show, I think we can both concur.
Oh, absolutely.
Dean Douglas did not enjoy this match. He had his chalkboard out and was going to talk about being beautiful and dominant. He had the word bad on the chalkboard. A failure to reach an acceptable standard, and calls Ramon the bad guy, and he dismisses the slang term, basically calling Ramon bad in the literal sense. And Ramon walks in on him and says he doesn't need a bookworm telling him how to fight. And then Ramon decks him, saying that he's all bluff and no stuff.
Decks him, and then how does Dean Douglas retaliate?
He whimpers on the floor.
And proceeds to scratch his nails on the chalkboard.
Oh, that's right. He climbs up to scratch the chalkboard out of anger.
It was so goofy, man.
It was. It was really goofy. And then Vince McMahon, just topping himself with one line after the other, says, "We just finished with one extraordinary match," as if to suggest we're due for another one. I don't care how optimistic you are. This main event was going to suck. And then we got Todd Pettengill with Diesel, who had a promo to match the quality of the match we were going to see, threatening to go medieval on King Mabel.
Wow.
I'm going to go medieval! He looked like he was going to have a heart attack from this promo because his head was shaking violently.
It's got to be embarrassing for these guys to rewatch some of these shows. Like
1995.
I said that?
This is it, Diesel. You know something? People are talking about the royal plan. Let me tell you something. I don't know if it was a smacks from Davey Boy Smith or Big Mabel dropping those legs on Big Daddy Cool. But Diesel's gone and Big Daddy Cool's alive. You want to play Knights in Shining Armor? I'm going to get it medieval on you, baby. I'm going to get medieval.
All right, indeed he will.
I'm going to go medieval on you, baby.
He couldn't even say on your ass. On you, baby.
Yeah.
Diesel and King Mabel.
The thankful thing, though, watching this on the network, I saw the timeline and that there was only 10 minutes left on this thing, so...
To their credit, thank God. They didn't get any wild thoughts that, hey, because it's the title match, it has to be 20 minutes, which is amazing when you fast forward to 2003. And what was the biggest complaint that they had about Bill Goldberg was, well, we can't have main events that go a short time. They've got to be 20-minute main events. It's like bullshit. You book to the strength of the performer. If he is bringing an audience with him, if there is a interest in him and this guy's over, you book to his strengths.
And it also, you know, relevant to today about the Ronda Rousey complaint that you often hear from many non-fans, you know, of the UFC about, you know, like I tell people about Ronda Rousey these days and non-MMA fans, and they all ask me, hey, I mean, these matches only end in like a minute. Do you feel ripped off? Never do I feel that way, because I feel like I'm watching something amazing happen every single time.
I've never bought into the idea that length is somehow... People will always, not to generalize everyone, but whenever people are making those fantasy cards, like, oh, WrestleMania next year, so-and-so versus so-and-so in an Iron Man match. Like, Iron Man matches, it's like people have this romantic idea that it's like, oh, that's the ultimate. To me, it's like an Iron Man match. Yeah. You're telling people ahead of time... This is going to be a 60-minute match. I don't think that's necessarily an appeal to people.
Not necessarily. Although, like, didn't, like, Chris Hero have, like, a...
Three and a half hour match.
And that itself is a very cool feat, you know? Especially, like, because he did it for charity.
It was charity. It was well-intentioned. And but I will guarantee you advertise
who's going
that
back to
people.
Yeah. And, like, you know, I don't really go back to, like, watch Brett versus Shawn either. You know what I mean? Like, the classic Iron Man match from WrestleMania 12. I might watch the last few minutes of it, but I don't necessarily want to watch the whole thing.
You know? I think that there's ways you can do lengthy matches, but I think broadcasting it ahead of time, that it is guaranteed to go this long, that's a huge challenge, as opposed to they just end up going the time limit.
This is also like a bad comparison, because we're talking about Mabel and Nash and not Shawn and Brett. But the thing is, like, an Iron Man match, I think, is still definitely a real draw, especially because you're talking about two people being there for upwards of an hour, at which point it becomes an incredible, just conditioning-wise, an incredible physical feat for two people to have a match that long. And I think that itself is a draw. You know what I mean?
I think that there's an audience that will soak something like that up. However, there have been times they have done that on TV, and it said the opposite, that people know they came back for the final 10 minutes. And there's a reason. WWF, you don't see Iron Man matches.
Yeah. I'd say it's probably smarter to do on a pay-per-view than a
compare
TV.
It to when, remember when John Cena and Shawn Michaels did the one on TV in the UK, and it went something like 55 minutes or something on TV, and they never announced ahead of time. It was just, wow, they've gone almost an hour at this point, and it was just, wow, this is incredible. You didn't expect it, whereas promoting it, we're going 60, I think that's a huge drawback to more people than it is a draw to people.
Depending on the performers, I'd say.
What if this was 60 minutes?
I'd probably...
I couldn't even fathom it.
My big question is, I wonder if Finn Balor ever made it this far on the tape, or if he just hit rewind after the Shawn and the Razor.
Can we discuss, like, what a tribute it is to Finn Balor that he has turned out such a tremendous performer when this was his favorite pay-per-view? I mean, there's very little to take from this in terms of being a defining event. Even with this ladder match.
Yeah.
This event, as a child, like, I guess maybe this was his only VHS copy. Maybe his parents bought
it. Hakushi match he really liked.
It's amazing the things that stick with people as they grow older.
Yeah.
Like, I was growing up in this period, and I can't say SummerSlam 95 was an event I looked back on with an immense fondness.
No.
But everyone's got their connections to things. Maybe it's a sentimental value.
Yep.
Back when he was... you know, just working on his Lego and listening to some early Nas in 95, perhaps. Diesel and Mabel. Mabel is carried to the ring by his servants, and he grabs the title away from Diesel and poses with it before the match. And then, as the match begins, turns to the crowd and yells,
to which the audience boos.
Did they boo?
Yeah, they booed. Yeah, we don't want that.
Well, they were booing him, not the fact that he wanted to be black champion. It's an odd thing for like heel champion to like the heel to yell though.
Well, this was Nelson Frazier maybe
playing Nelson Mandela
at this point. I mean, this was going to be his defining moment.
Yeah,
and this was the biggest match of his WWF career.
Sure.
I mean, pre Viscera and, you know, pre World's Largest Love Machine. Mm-hmm. Diesel hits him with some elbows and a scoop slam. And then Mabel vertical suplex Diesel over the top onto the barricade. No, he didn't. I was seeing if you were listening.
Come on.
Mabel does go to the floor, and Diesel attempts a pescado. He nearly falls flat on his face because his legs catch on top. This is maybe the most athletic, ambitious spot I've ever seen Kevin Nash attempt.
Yeah, you can't say Kevin Nash was lazy here, okay? As was probably, the criticism of him throughout later on in the 90s. He was trying here, but how much trying could you needed to try a lot.
Now, when you say you looked at the time, I mean, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to be able to look and convert this to what the real time was in this particular era. Pay-per-view started at 7 p.m. We're at roughly 9:35, 9:40. As Vince warns cable providers, we are taking this to the max. Cable providers, be ready. Mm. As if to like throw people off that this is going to go 20 minutes. I mean, this just, seriously? Thank God I had this timer, because if I was watching this live, I would have just groaned at the idea of 15 more minutes of this.
So you're saying we're near 11 o'clock at this point?
Well, it would have been 10 at that point, because the window was 7 till 10, I think, at this time. So anyway, they were not going to come close to the top of the hour. I think it was just to throw people off.
This match definitely felt like it was cut short.
Well, this was one of the shorter main events at the time. I mean, they, even by Diesel standards, this was short. I mean, they cut drastically back when Nash won the title on their main event times. Mabel hits a side slam, but it was more Diesel just taking a flat back bump with Mabel's arm around him.
One of the ugliest sidewalk slams I've ever seen.
He just sits on the back of Diesel. And then Mabel runs into Earl Hebner, who's dead as a result of this. This allows Mabel and Moe to double-team Diesel. And then Lex Luger runs in for the save. But Diesel fights him off and clotheslines Luger to the floor, which is never acknowledged.
Diesel attacked Luger?
Diesel clotheslined Luger to the floor. Mm. And I'm almost convinced it was a mistake.
No, they talked about how they weren't sure if Luger was going to come out to help or attack Diesel. So they were working some type of feud.
Okay.
I don't know.
Because I was confused here.
Yeah.
This was, you know, obviously a week away from Luger defecting over to WCW when his contract was up. And it was well known at this point that his contract was coming due. It wasn't, and even the fact it was out at this time that WCW was making a play for him. So it wasn't the secret everyone kind of makes it out to be, though it was a pretty surprising moment when he actually did show up on Nitro. Nevertheless, this would be Luger's final WWF pay-per-view appearance. Mabel then leg drops him on the floor. Luger fights Moe to the back, and Diesel is left in the ring. Mabel hits a belly-to-belly for a two count. The crowd pops for Diesel kicking out. Mabel barely misses a splash off the second turnbuckle as Diesel isn't quick enough to get out of the way. And then Diesel comes off the second turnbuckle with a clothesline. A clothesline for the flat finish. 9:15 this went, and he wins with a fucking clothesline.
Yeah.
A pretty poor one at that.
Like, what kind of a finishing move is that? I know you're not going to jackknife this dude, but like a clothesline.
Like, we need a secondary finish for you, Kev. What can you do?
Clothesline off the second rope.
I'll go off the second rope for you guys.
Fuck. This was about as shitty of a match as you'll ever see in a main event, I think. Like, I might even put the Lawrence Taylor Bam Bam match from that year ahead of this.
I would put that ahead.
Especially coming after Shawn and Razor to see this, you know. I definitely thought this was the worst match of the show.
Could almost make a hell of an argument to have put that ladder match on last.
Yeah.
So
I mean, there's not as much storyline, but I suppose.
This was a very terrible main event, and maybe it deserves more criticism from me because it was the main event. It was the title match. This is a pretty low level for a title match, even by 95 standards.
Yeah.
I still feel that Undertaker comma match was just, I hated that match so much.
A few minutes longer, about 7 minutes longer.
Could you imagine these guys going 16?
No. As was probably originally scheduled.
Oh, my God.
Because the way this pay-per-view ended, it just cut off.
It ended real quick. Yeah. Like, Nash just posed on the turnbuckle, and we were done. No even sign-off from Vince and Hendricks.
Like, imagine how stressed Vince must have been having to call this match.
Perhaps.
The match just, like, being shit, first of all, and then running close to the pay-per-view window as well.
I wonder when their cutoff was, because this is, like, this show is, like, 2 hours and 43 minutes.
That's also the Coliseum version, which they might have seen.
You're right. You're right. So there might have been stuff cut out. So I don't know.
Maybe that's where the Davey Boy stuff was.
I wonder if you're right. Yeah, maybe you were. I don't know.
Correct us. Fact check.
Well, people can look that part up. But there you go. That was SummerSlam 95. Not the greatest pay-per-view in history, but a great match.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely one great match. You know, for me, again, you know, I'm very nostalgic for this era. It's just fun to see, like, Triple H in this gimmick, to see Bret in his prime, to see Shawn and Razor like that. So for me, it was more fun to watch than anything. So I give this a 7.
Wow, a 7?
Yeah.
I give this one a 6, and I give, like, 4 of that towards the ladder match.
Yeah.
And the rest...
Deserved.
I mean... Hakushi and Waltman, they had a good match.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't, like, steal the show or anything like that, but probably the second best match on the show.
Definitely.
So there you go. That was SummerSlam 95. A fun little show to go back and watch during the diesel era of the WWF, as the WWF was running on diesel power before they would get back to regular with Bret Hart later that year.
Unleaded.
Unleaded. They were being leaded by a terrible champion at this point.
Oh.
So that was SummerSlam 1995.
Yeah.
What a review.
Yeah, I can't believe... Oh, man. It felt like such a long time.
It took us forever to review this show this week. But we have a lot of feedback to get to for this particular show. We'll start off with Matt in suburban Detroit. SummerSlam 95 was pretty bad, but there were some bright spots. Hakushi having a solid match with Sean Waltman and costing Skip a match against the greatest jobber ever, Barry Horowitz. Bret Hart versus Hall of Famer Isaac Yankem. Kane was all right, but Yankem was a star. Bret showed his heel side using the cable spot he used against Kevin Nash, that fake diesel. And Razor Ramon carrying Shawn Michaels. This sounds like a total troll response here.
Or sarcastic.
Sarcastic. That troll has replaced sarcasm in our vernacular.
They're kind of different.
All right. Well, he gives this show 4 out of 10.
Okay, we go to Bret currently in Fort McMurray.
Currently.
That's what
the GPS would lead us to.
How brutal were those ladders? Kudos to WWE for getting stronger ladders in the years that followed. Was the finish botch? Yes, I would assume so. He goes, good match, but the Mania one was better. Main event sucked. What else can you say? Mabel is bad, but looks okay when someone can run around him, and Nash has never been that guy. So, 93 amazing 90s mullets out of 10.
We go to McWhalen. 1995, the darkest year of the 90s in terms of North American wrestling. Smoky Mountain closed, Hogan was ruling WCW, and gimmicks were the mainstay in WWF. Funny enough, this is the third 1995 WWF pay-per-view you two have done. Hilarious.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Anyway, this was in the midst of the diesel power era of the WWF. The buy rates and live attendance for the WWF that year tanked, and it took them 3 years to catch up to WCW.
The third one we've done this year from 95.
Yes, three of the however many 5 pay-per-views there were in 1995. Let us skip down. Triple H made his WWE pay-per-view debut. Lex Luger made his final pay-per-view appearance for the WWE, and the women's title was defended for the last time on pay-per-view until its return in 1998. Undertaker comma went too long, but it finally put to rest the lame Undertaker-DiBiase feud, which felt like an eternity, even though it only lasted 1 year.
We go to Christian Small, who says, the opener was pretty decent. I felt like stating the obvious when I say Sean Waltman is amazingly overlooked. He was always a great worker, and he gelled well with Hakushi. Alundra Blaze is kind of forgotten for her ring work. Felt her and Faye had a very fun match. While he had an awful gimmick, Glenn Jacobs was very impressive in 95. He was very athletic and had a decent match with Bret. The ladder match was fantastic. Really good storytelling that even overcame the botched finish and Sean's infamous hissy fits being involved. I loved how Razor Ramon worked over the leg and nothing, but when Sean heard it, as the match progressed, every little thing was a major fight.
We go to Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. Can't believe how pumped I actually was for the Mabel Diesel main event, but believe me, this is still one of my favorite pay-per-views from the 90s. The latter match was, in my opinion, better as far as storyline goes and nicely tied to the previous one of more than a year earlier, which is sadly something nowadays you rarely see. Rest of the card was okay for the time, but nothing you couldn't catch on any given episode of Superstars. Long live Isaac Yankum, DDS.
We go to Dallas, who says, I confess, like Finn Balor, this was one of my favorite shows at the time. I don't know why. I had a decent collection of tapes at the time, but being 15 years old, I probably can't explain a lot of actions. That's not to say I now think the show is terrible. It at least has a few bright spots in the Michaels Razor match and Hakushi 1-2-3 Kid match. Everybody will talk about the Diesel-Mabel main event as a sign of the weak roster, but let's face it, when Barry Horowitz is getting a push, we are really scraping the bottom of the talent barrel.
DZ, I'll confess it, I thought King Mabel was the shit. From the entrance and his music, the MC Hammer genie pants, and him randomly yelling, I'm the king, throughout his matches. I wanted him to beat that lame-ass dude with attitude Diesel. Match wasn't much, but I never cared about match quality then. Well, then you were satisfied with that main event, because there was none.
Bruce from Vancouver. Just have to register my shock and disgust that the Harris brothers barely concealed Nazi SS tattoos minutes before Barry Horowitz would come out to have a Nagila, ironically. Can't say I ever noticed them at the time, but that certainly puts the Gang Wars programs into a new light. Yeah, you just told me about that. I just discovered that myself.
I wasn't even aware of this tattoo story. It was never something that was a story that I really was aware of. And he did post a photo here of both the Blue Brothers here. This looks to be at some WWF fan fest from the 90s. But
I mean, if you Google images of them even recently, they're still kind of there, but concealed. And in fact, like I ran across a thing back in NWTNA where they're part of the SEX, and Don Harris came out in an SS logo shirt.
Yeah,
and TNA actually issued an apology after that.
Yeah, that was in 2002. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's pretty.
It's probably some like motorcycle gang thing.
I don't know what it is.
Who knows?
But, yeah, not a great part of history, I guess it is, for wrestling. Connor from Dublin, Ireland. Had to drop some feedback on this event, as I too share a similar experience that Finn Balor had himself. Being close in age and also being from Ireland too, this event was a well-worn-out tape along with SummerSlam 92 in my household, growing up as the WWF was not very accessible outside of Action Zone on a Saturday morning. It is for that reason I share a soft spot for what is known as a pretty lackluster event in most people's eyes. I rewatched the event on the network over the weekend and brought back a lot of nostalgia. The opener was a good fast-paced match, and I remember being amazed by Hakushi and still think now he was an underrated wrestler in WWF at the time. I also remember being legit scared as a kid that Bret Hart was going to die when he got caught up in the ropes, and despite the fact his gimmick stunk, really felt the post-match angle and Bret selling really pushed the Yankum across as a killer to an 8-year-old me. Loved the ladder match and believe it was better than the WrestleMania 10 match, and it told a much better story. The main event wasn't as bad as people think, and I'd take it over another Randy Orton John Cena SummerSlam main event any day. 7 out of 10. Quick question for you guys. I am making my way over to WrestleMania for the first time this year, and I was wondering if you could give me some advice based on your previous experiences or on what activities are must-do during WrestleMania week outside of the Review Away gathering, of course. And coming from Ireland, is there any food or drink you guys would want as gifts? Maybe some Irish chocolate or some bottles of genuine Irish Guinness. Well, as you know,
yeah. We'll
take anything.
Definitely. Oh, that Irish Guinness sounds awesome.
In terms of going to Dallas or wherever you're staying around there, I have been to Dallas. And if you do venture to downtown Dallas, it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of stuff to do in the downtown area. And I'm looking forward to going. And for WrestleMania weekend, I mean, there's going to be so much going on.
I'll say definitely the NXT show, if they do one this year.
I'm sure they will. NXT will be a lot of fun.
It'll be the hottest ticket prior to WrestleMania.
You know, ROH and the WWN live shows, those will be outstanding. I always enjoy the Hall of Fame. Access, I think you can miss if you're trying to fit everything in. That's a skippable one.
The thing about Access is that if you've never done it, you know, and you love
WWE, one time you should go.
Yeah, and once you've been there once, you don't have to go again. It's usually the same thing every year. You know, get used to the long lineups, which for a lot of people I think might be worthwhile if you really want to get that autograph from, you know, somebody on the roster. Yes, totally. And to see all the costumes and all that, it's a little pricey, but it's worth it to go at least once, I'll say.
Yeah, I would suggest.
And the NXT matches too that they'll have.
Yeah, they do. Last year they did the tournament to get with Hideo Itami. Me getting into the battle royal at the Access Special. I would suggest if you're coming all the way over from Ireland, stay for Raw on the Monday. Don't worry about SmackDown on Tuesday. That's definitely one day too many.
Yeah, but definitely stay for the Raw. Absolutely.
And of course, the Review Way meetup.
That is the biggest thing.
The reason most are flying.
Details to come.
Yes, details to come. Okay, next up is you.
Okay, we go to Vince from Vaughn, who says, I saw the show on pay-per-view 20 years ago, and the only thing I remember back then was Brett getting caught in the ropes against the dentist. Now, having watched the show again, my opinion has not changed. This show is quite forgettable.
And finally, David Duffenberg, when you chose the show to review, I was excited. The only reason I was excited is because I was looking for a reason to watch Diesel versus King Mabel. I'm a fan of a good train wreck, and that match definitely delivered. As a kid, though, I do remember thinking Mabel would win the title. As odd as it was to push him, at least they got behind the King gimmick. King Mabel was booked to make us believe he could beat Diesel, while King Barrett has been pushed to wrestler R-Truth 839 times. Sadly, King Mabel was a better book king. That you cannot deny. They at least got some mileage
definitely out
of Mabel.
Yeah. But you're also coming off of, what is it, like Owen winning
the year prior.
Yeah. So, like, back then, like, it actually meant something.
Oh, it did. It did. I remember watching the show when Barry Horowitz finally got a win. They had been hinting that he was due for a victory leading up to his match against Skip. It was a fun angle back at the time. I agree with everyone else in thinking the Undertaker match went far too long. This could have been a solid 5 or 6 minute match, but there was no need for it to go as long as it did. A few of the matches on this show felt too long because the wrestlers couldn't carry the match or nobody gave a crap about the characters. The nostalgia couldn't bump this up too much in my overall score. I give it 5 out of 10, and that feels generous. I was entertained, but it wasn't in a good way. Some of the time. Well, if you got some enjoyment out of it, that's what mid-90s shows are for.
And I do wonder, like, there's no criteria from anybody that says you have to watch the entire show. You know what I mean? Like, if there are only bits and pieces out of this that you want to go back and see, that's the benefit you have that we don't.
You can,
the privilege you have that we don't. We got to sit through everything.
No, it doesn't, everyone listening should watch every morsel.
You guys don't need to do
that. We review. You know, as you talk about the Undertaker comma going too long 20 years ago, this Sunday, I feel Lesnar-Taker could run into the same trap, that this is a match, granted you had the concussion the last time. We also have seen in the previous incarnation, these two had some very good matches together. I think this match on Sunday, we were talking about it Sunday on the Law. I mean, it should not be going 20-plus minutes, I don't feel.
I don't think so either. How much was their Mania match? Not to say like that's a you know, enough of a comparison because the guy was concussed, but at least you get a sense of how long they wanted to go for that match.
Let's get the exact. It was definitely like a lengthy match. Mm. It was Taker Lesnar 25 minutes that match went, which, and Taker got concussed early in that match.
And I would hope that they probably learned from that. I would think that even if Taker was concussed, it wasn't necessarily going to be like a world of difference in terms of quality anyway. I feel like, and you're also going to, I'm assuming you're going to have a match where Taker won't be taking those German suplexes.
No.
That have become the signature of these matches.
I could see him taking, though, one or two.
Yeah.
Not a crazy amount, but you almost have to do that spot.
I think they'd be smart to keep it far less than that.
All right. Well, that is going to bring this week's edition of Review Away to a close. But next week on the program, we will be back. And way we are going the cinematic direction for next week's review, a WWE Studios review.
Oh, boy.
You chose this one.
No, I didn't.
Didn't you?
No, I didn't.
Who did?
I gave you a few options.
Oh, you did. I selected this one.
What were my options?
Dude, I can't even remember.
Okay, my options were some other movie I don't remember. But it was something, it was the one movie. It was The Wrestler, Mickey Rourke movie,
yep.
Or this, and John wanted to choose this.
I did choose the Marine 4 moving target over The Wrestler.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious to watch this movie. Maybe it'll have some camp value to it. Or maybe it'll be a phenomenal movie that's just flowing under the radar.
Maybe it'll
been a, it's been a moving target for critics.
Right. Maybe it'll be a breakout performance by Summer Rae, who is featured on a poster. She well, could she could have a very large
gotta
role.
Have a big role.
Yeah.
She's definitely, you know, second from the top with Mike the Miz Mizanin as Jake Carter.
We're going into this not having seen any of the Marine movies.
No, I've seen the first.
Oh, you have seen the first.
Yeah, but okay. 2 and 3 are gaps.
Not to say I don't think you need to know much backstory to
I don't think there's
movie.
Much continuity from story to story.
No.
Of the exploits of the various Marines.
He's a guy who shoots guns.
Maybe they're eventually going to have a fourth Marine, and this will lead to a Survivor Series
match. You mean a fifth Marine?
Well, no, because Miz has played it in now two of the films.
Oh, you mean the fourth actor?
We need a fourth guy to play it after the Miz.
I don't see Ted DiBiase coming back anytime soon.
Just for that Survivor Series.
A Marine match?
A Marine-themed Survivor Series match.
Huh. And who could they go up against?
Well, the mercenaries. Volkov, Boris Zhukov.
Right.
I mean, gotcha. you could play a patriotic
I would angle. Actually wouldn't mind seeing a WWE Studios Battle Royal, and you can have
Jacob Goodnight.
Yeah, Triple H as the chaperone.
Oh, my God.
The Big Show as the...
The worst pay-per-view in history. Playing
the
their different roles. Oh, my God. Jake Carter is like the badass babyface.
Yeah.
Do you know who was originally to play the Marine in the very first one? It wasn't John Cena.
Who was it?
Steve Austin.
I was going to say Austin.
Yep.
I think Austin would have been good.
He probably would have been good.
Didn't we watch The Condemned, which is basically the same movie?
I can't remember. I've seen a few of Austin's movies. I don't know which they are.
They're all the same.
Damage. I saw Damage.
Whatever. It's the one that he goes out to the and he shoots guns. Like, well, it's all these movies.
Yeah, that is all of them. Well, that will bring an end to Review Away. A very fun review of the 1995 SummerSlam. So good that Way is going to go back and rewatch The Undertaker and Kama and Diesel Mabel to get a better understanding of which was the worst match in 1995 and how the product, the legacy of this pay-per-view is going to be Finn Balor.
It really is.
For a whole generation.
Yeah. 20 years. The 20-year anniversary.
This event, it helped inspire one Fergal Devitt to pursue professional wrestling. Always thinking of... Isaac Yankum, DDS, and Hakushi.
Mm-hmm.
And this was it's just amazing. That is all for us. We're going to end this now. LiveAudioWrestling.com. It is Way's favorite website. It's in his top five.
Not my favorite.
Oh, boy. No. What a dick.
Not even in the top five.
Well, maybe Way will be back next week. We'll see. And until then, good night, goodbye, and let's end with some dental promos from Jerry Lawler, Bret Hart, Todd Pettengill, Jerry Lawler. This was the high point of the Isaac Yankum run.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You got another pun for us? One more to sign off?
No. It's like pulling teeth.
Oh, God. That's rough. Oh, man.
Standing by now, ladies and gentlemen, we have Todd Pettengill with the Hitman, Bret Hart, I believe. Todd, are you there?
Thank you very much. Obviously, Jerry Lawler has been drilling this message into the fans' heads. He's going to try to extract revenge. Again, Jerry Lawler keeps poking at the Hitman, Bret Hart. Bret, this is your chance to finally shut the mouth of the Burger King once and for all, and you're going to have to do it with Isaac Yankum, DDS.
Let's all hope and pray that that's the case. Jerry Lawler, he's still brooding about the fact that he lost and had his foot and my foot crammed down his dirty, stinking throat. But Isaac Yankum, DDS, it's a different story. This guy's a big guy. He's a tough guy. He talks about how big and bad he is. You know, Jerry Lawler, you can go ahead and send a chiropractor or anybody you want after me, because one after another, they're all going to go down. Isaac Yankum, DDS, you big tooth fairy, I'm going to knock a hole through you this big. You know what? I might just knock all his teeth right out of his face.
Yeah, right.
Jerry Lawler, I've had it up to here with you, and Isaac Yankum, you're stepping in the ring with the excellence of execution. I don't care if you're a dentist. You better look at me, because I am. The best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be, and you are going down.
That's an orthodontist dream right there. I didn't realize Bret Hart had such nice teeth for a beaver.